In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
How are you feeling about inflation right now? More importantly, how are those feelings impacting your financial decisions? From SDPB, today is Monday, July 8th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Rick Kaler joins us for a look at how the very definition of inflation and how we leverage that definition is shifting along with American politics. We will check in on a traveling exhibit that seeks to spark innovation in South Dakota. That's coming a bit later in the hour. South Dakotans are suffering after June floods have transformed their lives into before and after. SDPB's CJ Keene has the update. But first, we get to know the newest cohort of Bush Fellows. Lily Mendoza with the Red Ribbon Skirt Society is with us after the news. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Every year, the Bush Foundation chooses a cohort of fellows from Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share the same geography. The Bush Fellowship identifies transformational leaders and guides them in expanding their influence in the service of their communities. The 2024 fellowship cohort includes Lily Mendoza. Mendoza is the founder of the Red Ribbon Skirt Society. She's a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and is with us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in Rapid City. Lily Mendoza, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me on air again.
And congratulations. Like,
oh, thank you.
Hugely.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Yeah.
What I was so excited when I saw your name, seriously. Lily, and I, what drew you to the Bush Fellowship as a next step in your personal journey?
Well, you know, I was really actually encouraged by some young women to do this. Those women and other women that have been actively involved in the Red Ribbon Skirt Society and have seen my work in community, they're the ones that suggested that I really actually apply for the Bush Fellowship.
Yeah, the application process itself can be very intimidating, but also clarifying as you're asked deep questions about your leadership and what's in the way for you. What do you want to do in the future? What, you know, whose shoulders do you stand on? Big questions like that. How did the application process and the mentorship that you received during that time sort of clarify what you wanted to do with the opportunity?
Right. Yeah. You know, doing this work and applying really did clarify some things for myself as an individual and the work that I've been doing and where I want to go with that work. And a big part of, of course, the fellowship is about me and people that apply for it. It's about about yourself, you know.
Yeah.
And so it made me really take a hard look at that and to think about myself as a Lakota woman and what I can do for myself to help others in the work that I am doing. And a huge part of that, as I was completing the application and rewriting, is how I can heal myself in our Lakota lifeways, really.
Mm-hmm. How hard was that? I mean, you're not starting from scratch.
No. I guess it just really made me take notice. It really made me take notice of the work that I'm doing. It made me take notice and reflect back on the women that have been very, very influential and powerful in my life from a child, and made me reflect back on watching them and the work that they did in community and their place in community as matriarchs.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? So how will you tell me some parts of your plan? And I know it's a comprehensive plan, so we're not going to unpack the whole thing for you, and some of it's private. But what are some of the ways that you're looking, moving forward and saying, big picture, I need to spend some time reflecting about this or traveling here or studying that? What's ahead for you?
Right. What I'll be doing actually is I will be going and visiting all of our sacred sites and spending time and reflection there on the land. I also will be meeting with elders and other Lakota women that are matriarchs and that know some of our ceremonial songs. That's a huge part of it. And although right now I do participate in ceremonies, having not learned my language growing up because we just weren't taught our language anymore, that'll be a big part of that. And I'm going to do that through song because it's a lot easier for me to learn through song. I have a degree in music, and so it's a little bit more familiar to me to learn that way. And so, yes, I'll be going to sacred sites all over South Dakota. One of my bigger adventures I will be doing is I will be walking in the Chief Bigfoot Ride in December. And starting that walk, it's a 300-mile walk, going to Wounded Knee. And a big part of that, everything that I'm doing is remembering, healing for our women, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
And so on this journey, I'm also really deeply looking into my own healing as well, because I can't help anybody if I can't heal myself.
Right. And that's hard to set a time frame on. Speaking from personal experience,
right,
you're like, okay, right. Well, this is a detour that I didn't anticipate happening.
Right.
What do you know at this point about your cohort as you look at some of the people that have also been selected? You will go through this journey with them.
Right.
Do you have initial thoughts on the scope of that cohort and what they might bring to conversations with you to help you as you implement your own plan?
You know, I think, you know, when we had our retreat in Minneapolis, I was present there with a lot of young people, okay?
Yeah.
And as I heard their stories and what their plans were, it was like I was listening to my children because I was the elder there, okay? And it was interesting to listen to their journeys and what an opportunity for these young people to begin this journey now. You know, I'm 66 years old, and I am just beginning this journey.
Yeah.
And it was pretty amazing to hear their stories, where they came from, their struggles, and where they want to be, you know. And my message to them was, you have a long road ahead of you. And if there's anything that I can do to help you on that journey, you know, just let me know.
Yeah. Help me understand when you plan, as you say, to go to a sacred site and spend time in reflection there. How do you prepare for that?
Well, I'm preparing right now, you know, because I'm going to be doing a lot of walking and a lot of hiking and looking at a seasonal approach to visit those sites. And so preparing, you know, I'm going to be participating in harvesting a buffalo. I'm going to learn about our traditional foods because that's really what I want to be able to take with me to kind of go back to that way of life and to experience that as our people experienced hundreds of years ago. And along the way also, of course, is learning those songs and just to be present on our land. And to take the time. We never have time to do these things. And so now I have an opportunity, you know, to do that. And I'm preparing now. It's going to be a long physical 2 years.
Yeah.
And so I'm already preparing for my very first walk in September.
I just am ready to hold whatever space that you feel fit in the moment for conversations about this going forward. Lily,
right.
I just respect and honor your journey. So thank you so much for stopping by again and sharing this part of it.
Right. Thank you so much. And just a little note, I'm going to be documenting everything. I'm going to be mapping my trails. I'm going to be doing a winter count. I'm going to be journaling, and I'm going to be filming so that I will have that at the end of 2 years to share.
Oh, that is so smart. Thank you.
I know, right?
Thank you for audio. Get audio, Lily.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay, excellent. All right. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lori.
people are still suffering after June flooding destroyed homes and ways of living in southeast South Dakota. They're also asking tough questions about government leadership and the flood plans of the future. SDPB's C.J. Keene joins us now from our Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City with an update. C.J., welcome back to In the Moment.
Good morning, Lori.
You were in southeast South Dakota last week. Tell us what the situation is like there.
So some communities are hit harder than others, but in the places where it's bad, it is pretty bad, especially in North Sioux City. You can go, and there are places where it seems like the roads have completely buckled in. Homes and churches have fallen into sinkholes. And right now, people are mostly focused on just starting to get their lives back together, honestly. They're just barely beginning to get back into their homes. And that's before you even mention things like the smell of sewage or all the mosquitoes that just make the whole situation a bit more difficult. It's already a challenging situation for everybody involved, especially those living close to the lake. This first audio clip is from a homeowner named Julie Burhoop, who was very helpful in connecting me with people in the community. And hers is reflective of a lot of people who maybe didn't lose everything, but they live right on the water.
I'd be out on the lake with the girls pulling them behind the boat. And we don't have that. I mean, it sounds so petty and so, but that was our life and it's gone. Now, instead of living on a lake, I live on a lagoon full of sewage, houses, trees. We don't know even what's under the water. The water is still probably 7 feet higher than what it's supposed to. There's silt. There's acres and acres worth of dirt.
All right. So this is an unsafe situation ongoing, but also a deeply emotional situation. You talked to some other homeowners about that. Tell me a little bit about Kathy Roberts.
So first and foremost, it's important to know that Kathy Roberts and her cats are okay, but she has lost everything. And the sense of trauma is very, very real. You can hear it in her voice. And just speaking to her, it's a challenge for her to get through.
It has been a horrible situation. As far as communication and information getting out, it's been extremely frustrating. My words don't come out right now. It's completely overwhelming beyond anything I've experienced in my life.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. We're talking to SDPB reporter C.J. Keene, who was in southeast South Dakota last week, checking in on the flood damage and homeowners and people who live there trying to pick up the pieces. Now, CJ, there's a lot of suffering going along, a lot of hard work, but also a lot of questions. Tell me a little bit about what people told you the response had been from the local government. What did you learn?
A lot of the local government is spinning a lot of plates. I briefly stepped into the city hall in North Sioux City, and it was, put simply, chaos. A lot of people trying to do their regular day-to-day municipal responsibilities, pay their bills, and get things figured out. But at the same time, they're getting calls upon calls from people who are just trying to get back to their homes and assess just how bad the situation is, because a lot of people still really don't know exactly how bad the damage is to their home. It could just be mold or their home could be lost. Now, some time has passed and roads are continuing to open up, but it is a lot of hurry up and wait with leaders kind of in a tough position where everybody wants to get back to their home, but it's dangerous out there. And
so that's the central, the hardest hit communities. What's the response been like in some other communities that were hit, but maybe not as intensely?
So I poked my head into Canton, South Dakota, and roads are still closed. The mayor there says that she has never seen the floodwaters get quite that high, but it is still definitely a sense of emergency in City Hall in Canton. You can see Red Cross boxes just waiting for people to use them. And Mayor Sandra Lundstrom definitely offered some very interesting perspective into what the situation was like, where she said 3/4 of the houses in the community had been flooded.
The biggest problem we had was the water rushing from out of the country into the city streets.
We had several streets underwater. Sandbagging was going on, and people were volunteer. We had hundreds of volunteers, which saved the city, along with saving people from themselves because they drove through barricades over running water on the roads.
All right, CJ, what's next? That's the big question. What are some of the highlights about what needs to happen next?
What's next really is the big question for everybody involved, especially those in the areas that have been hit the hardest. There's a sense of questioning the efficiency of the community flood plans. Mm-hmm. Some are saying that there wasn't enough warning. Others are saying that communication was quite poor in the immediate aftermath of the flooding. And some are wondering if the most recent FEMA flood plans are still effective. For what it's worth, the Canton Mayor, Sandra Lundstrom, she says that she still believes that their flood plan is mostly on the whole. They just need to take some small looks at it. But others, once again, Julie Burhoop, are offering some pretty steep questions that their local leaders are going to need to address.
The FEMA flood plan from back in 1971 said block up the interstate, let some of that water, extra water, divert into McCook Lake because that's where it's going to find its level. But it feels like that plan stopped with blocking the interstate, and it felt like it needed to go a lot more steps past that.
Well, this is an ongoing story. You can find all our flood reporting at sdpb.org. Reach out to In the Moment at SDPB if you want another angle tackled here as we figure out what has happened and what to do next. CJ Keene, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Happy to do it, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Language is constantly shifting and changing. Sometimes the popular understanding of the meaning of a word changes, even if the actual definition doesn't. Rick Kaler says that's what's happening with the word inflation. Its meaning is morphing for a certain segment of the general public, but not for economists. Kaler is a wealth advisor and president of Kaler Financial in Rapid City, and he's with us on the phone for another financial therapy session. Rick Kaler, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. When you asked me to speak on this topic, I thought, well, finally we're going to get away from financial therapy.
And yet, because we don't get away from our emotions, right?
Looking a little harder. And it's I found 9 cognitive biases here.
All right. So, and I did some checking just with, you know, I went through a bunch of different popular news sites this morning to see what was their most recent reporting on inflation. And your point that you're making in this companion blog is really, you know, held up by the evidence of some of the stories that I saw that people were putting out just this morning of how are we handling this narrative of inflation. Help people understand what you were noticing about how we even talk about inflation and what it means.
Yeah, as a personal finance, financial planner, investment advisor, inflation has a pretty clear definition, and it's typically what's called the consumer price index, and that is the annual rate at which goods and services are increasing in price, or deflation, which they possibly could be decreasing in price. So when I kept hearing on all the media, the news reports, cable TV, in writing, how high inflation was. And I've written several columns on this in the past year or two, because inflation did get up to 9.2%, somewhere in there. And it fell faster than it's ever fallen in history, from 9% to around 3%. And 3% is the historical inflation rate, 3.3%, right around there. Mm-hmm. And so when inflation's been around there for, I don't know, a year, maybe, yeah, maybe 18 months, 2 years, yeah, I'm like, what high inflation? Inflation is not high. Inflation is normal. Yeah. And it just didn't occur to me until I read a bit by Mike Allen in Axios that, well, it depends on what your definition of inflation is, and that half the country is interpreting the definition of inflation as higher prices. And, you know, we've talked a lot about that every financial behavior, no matter how illogical it seems to you or others, makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
When we understand the underlying belief system, now that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
If your definition of inflation is higher prices, and we would see that, yes, inflation's 19.2% since the pandemic, well, the increase, the average increase in prices is 19.2%.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
All right. So we could... And I think there's some ways that when you're in a conversation with somebody who doesn't understand this, or if you're feeling worried about inflation, there's some questions that you could ask yourself that might be particularly useful. I always start with, like, are you afraid you can't pay your grocery bill? You know, what is coming up in your mind that is making you think inflation? Otherwise, you know, we get into the semantics and some people just aren't going to care. But what's happening emotionally with our reaction, which is somewhat stark, to prices.
Yeah, exactly. And you've nailed it. It is, there's an emotion of fear, and the fear is in the higher prices. And there's a number of biases. For example, anchoring bias is evidence here, because I'm anchoring on the high price. And I think we've talked about this before. I termed it Mars bars inflation, is that we tend to equate higher prices with what we buy most. And we buy more Mars bars more frequently than, say, a new television or a washing machine or something like this. We've actually seen prices decrease on many large purchases, but we haven't seen prices decrease so much on food and items that we buy a lot. So there's just the fear that my income is not keeping up with the higher prices, which is partially true. We've had a 19% increase in prices over a period of time, and this data might be 3 months old or so. At the same time, we've had about a 15% increase in wages.
Yeah. So here's another thing I want to unpack with you, which is I was thinking about the things I buy the most, and eggs. Remember when eggs were like $7, $8 for a dozen? We were all panicking about eggs. And now I bought them this weekend for a very reasonable price at the same place where I was seeing those prices elevated before. Are we walking around telling people, though, whew, price of eggs came down? Like, we talk about it when it goes up. But when it goes back down, which often it doesn't go back down, but when it does go back down, we still don't mention eggs are affordable again. What's going on there? Is it like just we want to talk about the negative thing, the most dramatic, scary thing? What's happening?
You nailed it. You ought to become a financial therapist. that's called negativity bias.
Okay.
And people tend to focus more on negative experiences, such as price increases, rather than positive or neutral ones. And then the confirmation bias kicks in when, if prices are actually falling, that's threatening to my worldview. Because my worldview is things are terribly high, and of course there's blame that can be associated with that, and that blame could align with my political beliefs. So I can't recognize the opposite, because then the house of cards starts falling apart, and that could mean I'm a failure, and just the emotional ramifications of that.
Mm. So. Let's start with different questions to ask yourself or to ask other people. What do you say when someone comes to you and says, oh, Rick, I can't put as much into my accounts this month because inflation is so high? Where would you begin with someone who is conflating the price of what have you with inflation?
I hate to disappoint you. Mm-hmm. My brain typically goes logical. Like, what?
What?
Inflation isn't high? So I have to take a deep breath myself and say, okay, what's your definition of inflation? Or tell me your understanding of what inflation is. And that's oftentimes not a place I go when people are using terms that to me are so clear cut. Retirement is a big one. And we've talked about that before when one fella that I came across, I said, what's retirement mean to you? And he says, it means you die.
Yeah. I love that. That's worth expanding. What does retirement mean to you? What even asking someone that question can pause them from the panic or pause yourself from your own panic to say, well, wait a minute, what are we even talking about? What does inflation mean to you?
Yeah. And this is so much with words and communication, and you said this in your opening. It's just a wonder that we communicate with each with one another at all.
Yeah.
And asking, just pausing to ask, what does that mean to you? I mean, that for me takes a lot. I've got to be in a really good place to get curious that maybe this person has a completely different definition. If I can get myself to that place, then we can have a productive conversation. And the conversation may not even be me trying to enlighten them, and to your point, that usually doesn't work. But then I could use inflation in their context. And that usually makes for the best communication, is when I can be using the person's words back to them in the context in which they understand them and they use them. And I'm not suggesting that we just throw out the definition of anything. The definition of inflation is still the CPI. And it's important that I at least first hear that other person and affirm them, oh, yes, prices are a lot higher, aren't they? Yes. So I get what you mean by inflation, meaning prices are higher. Yeah, you get it.
Yeah, we're all living in that
We're
all living in that post-pandemic world right now. One of the news stories I saw this morning had two parents talking about the cost, what they spend on camps during the summer months, and how they were struggling. Two journalists talking about how they were struggling with their own kids in camps. And one of them said, well, inflation is so high, you have to work more to send your kid to more camps. And in like 20 seconds, they had spiraled into, and I was getting stressed, and I don't even have a school-aged child anymore. And I was like, I could feel my heart racing. And I was like, wow, this is kind of terrifying. But when you slow it down, they were talking, first of all, about, you know, pony camp and things that I think are probably out of reach financially for a lot of South Dakotans. But people spend a lot of money on childcare, essentially. But underlying this was the fear that their kids were going to fall behind in school, was the fear that they were working too much as mothers, was the fear that there were safety concerns, was the fear that they weren't spending enough downtime with their family. It was fear, 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 fear.
Yes.
And I had to take, so you and I have talked about this before, like step away from the grift, for one thing, of selling you something because they're making you afraid. And ask yourself questions like, well, what does summer mean to me? How much does a good summer cost?
Yes.
Take a breath.
Getting down to that emotional fear, that fear of loss, sadness, grief, back to what we talk about all the time, is not just about the money.
Yeah.
It's what does that represent to me, and what is that bringing up for me? And loss of connection, a number of things.
Yeah. The you're vulnerable if you stay in that heightened emotional state with money and fear-mongering. You're vulnerable to making some really bad decisions, first of all, but also being parted with your money by people who are trying to sell you a solution that maybe isn't a solution at all. Do you see that all the time in financial planning, where people have made decisions when they were particularly afraid of something that they go back and they say, I regret that decision. I need to slow down the decision-making process, whether they're moving money in an investment or giving money or refusing to give money. Do you see people dealing with the consequences of rapid decision-making based on fear?
All the time. All the time. What I don't see is the second half of your statement, people saying, you know what, I need to slow down because I really see how I was moving too fast. I see how the emotions were triggering me. That's the part that I don't see as much. Mm-hmm. We tend to live in the trigger. We tend to live with the, well, of course, I had to get out because the market was falling. And they got out at the bottom, or purchases they made, whatever it is. It's the reflection. Once we get to the reflection and the understanding, the pause, oh, wow, look at what was going on. Then there's hope for future decisions. And that's a lot of what we just try to help people with is getting to that awareness of what was going on when those financial decisions were being made.
Right. And that means you have to feel these feelings. So when you see a high price, say the eggs go back up, or they're up in your town. Let's say you didn't have the experience that I had where the eggs were very affordable all of a sudden, and you feel that panic. You have to sit with that feeling for a minute instead of just rushing off to blame whoever's, you know, in the White House right now or will be in November. That's a hard thing to do, to sit with the
really
discomfort.
Hard to do. It's so easy for you and I to talk about it.
Yeah.
But in that moment, those feelings can be triggered so quickly, like in a nanosecond. That just taking that time to be with the feelings that are coming up, that's it. That makes all the difference in the world and gives us a chance to bring perspective onto it.
Well, we thank you for this pause to think about inflation today. Wealth advisor, author, financial therapist Rick Kaler, really one of the international leaders in financial therapy, and a longtime guest of this show. You can find all his companion blogs. We'll put some links up on our website, sdpb.org. Rick Kaler, thank you so much. It's always also really just nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Lori. Take care.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new single from musicians Ted and Alice Miller is a tribute to an old friend. You just heard a little part of Tire Track Smoke and Blues coming out of the break. A little intro. We're going to play more of that song in a minute. But first, we wanted to welcome Ted Miller joining us with the story behind the song. He is seated in SDPB's studios at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. Ted, welcome back. Hey.
Hey, Lori, thanks for having me back.
I want to let you tell the story of this song before we let people hear a little bit more of it. How did this song come to you, the idea?
Well, it's been in existence for a long time. First off, thanks so much for having us back. This is always great. So the story starts basically, I was an eighth grader going into freshman year, right in that realm, not to date myself too much, but me and my friend Arlen Lammers were, we were the angsty, rebellious kids, you know. We would sit in the backyard in the town I grew up in, and we'd sit back there and think we're on top of the world smoking cigarettes, you know, and being those kids. And whenever we would run out, we would walk across the alley to the local place that would sell us cigarettes, and we'd walk back and keep being those cool kids, right? Well, one day when it had snowed a lot, so we were on our way over to get more, and some vehicles had gone through the alley, so Arlen and I were each in one respective tire track to stay out of the deep snow. And I just remember randomly saying to Arlen, I'm like, Arlen, someday we should write a song called Tire Track Smoke and Blues. He's like, yeah, man, we should, you know. And youth moves fast and quick, and you can get sidetracked. And we never got around to doing it together. But after Arlen passed away, you know, that thought of that song just always stuck with me. And the riff in that song, the opening riff, was kind of came about early in that revelation to maybe write that song. So that's been around a really long time. And like I said, after Arlen passed, I really got, you know, chargy to really want to work on it. And Alice helped finish it. We wrote it together. Alice knew Arlen too. And here it is. Yeah, so yeah. It's the song. And another fun little fact, I guess, is it's the first time that Alice has, we've set up the microphones and learned how to do it. But most of her recording, percussion-wise, has been her cajon and various other instruments. But this is the first time we've saddled up with the full drum kit. So that's Alice on the drums.
Nice, nice. Tell me a little bit about, I think, for people who are just getting started in music and in songwriting, trusting that process, that something that maybe you started years ago, in this case decades, could still inform you, and that the song would be different when you wrote it at this age than if you had written it when you were 17.
That is very true. You know, like when I first started working on it, you know, years and years later, as of more recent, you know, I had this idea in my head that this is the way it was going to be, you know, and this was, you know, I kind of initially kind of started looking at it as a solo project, really. Not that I always knew Alice would have a part, but in the writing of it, I'm like, you know, Arlen and I were pretty tight back then. And, but as I was playing it with my musical partner, you know, and like she's hearing this and adding this, and you're right. If we would have wrote that song when I was a freshman in high school, who knows how it would have turned out, right? As opposed to now.
Yeah, but yet I am also fascinated by this idea that, like, you had the title as a young man. You were already thinking about the blues. There was something about the moment that you recognized as being blues-worthy.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, it's amazing how that really did stick. How I recognized his tire track, Smoke and Blues, and came up with that bass line, not bass line, but the bass riff of that song, the main riff. And it was really funny because it took that long, because I had that riff forever and I could just never really move past, how am I going to put lyrics to this? I've been playing this riff since I've been, you know, an eighth grader, and luckily, however that spirit works, it all channeled out. I hope I'm answering that question.
Yeah, correctly, I'm you know, you said angsty. I guess that's why I'm gently pushing back on the word angsty, and expanding it to in touch with an emotion that people for a very long time have said, you know, this belongs in a certain musical expression. It's a mood. Yeah. It's a mood, and it should be nurtured, maybe not squashed. If you're feeling angsty right now, write a song. Is that what I'm saying? I don't know.
Right, so you're pushing back on that. I get that. Yeah, because it didn't come across as an angsty song, did it? I guess that was just maybe our mind frame of who we thought we were then.
Yeah, right? We're going back and looking at how we were as younger artists and then saying maybe that wasn't so bad after all. Maybe we were actually onto something.
Yeah.
And now we know what to do with it because we have the emotional maturity.
Absolutely. I like that.
It's my hypothesis, Ted, on your music.
Oh, thank you. I love hearing people's
far more about than I do, of course.
Oh, well, thanks for that. That's a really fun way to look at that.
Yeah. Let's play a little bit more of the song. I'm going to say thank you to Ted Miller with Ted and Alice. You usually know them by, it's called Tire Track Smoking Blues. It's available now. You can find it and stream it wherever you get your music. Ted, thanks so much.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks so much for always inviting us back in. It means a lot. Alice couldn't be here today. She wanted to, but I'm sure she's listening.
Yeah, so. say hello. Hello, Alice. See you next. We'll see you next time in next song.
Bye-bye. Socks are soaking wet.
Now, every innovation, every response to a problem is as unique as the community that comes up with a solution. Now, a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian Institution celebrates the inventive spirit of rural America. SPARK, Places of Innovation, is from the Smithsonian's Museum on Main Street, and the exhibit tour is sponsored by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Lorinda Tapper is the Public Relations Coordinator of the Rapid City Public Library, where the exhibit is currently on display, and she is with us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Lorinda Tapper, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is my typical shout out for the Rapid City Public Library social media feed. You guys do great work. So I'm just going to say
that
again.
Thank you. We have a lot of fun making it.
I love you on Instagram, those librarians. Tell us a little bit about this exhibit and then furthermore about the programming, because each place that the exhibit travels on its tour throughout the state will come up with their own community program. So start with the exhibit itself, please, and then we'll get into the programming.
Yeah, so the exhibit actually, it highlights the innovation of rural America. They are solving issues that impact their communities. And so it's telling stories of self-reliance and creativity that sustain the vitality of their rural community. And it just shows their fresh thinking and new solutions. And, you know, it's funny, when I first heard about this, about how it's about innovation, I immediately thought, just technology. And it's not. It's there is technology there, but it's also ideas related to the arts and culture and just bettering our society and making our communities more livable and healthier and just beautiful.
Yeah. It's kind of inspiring to look at some of the social or artistic or technological or cultural examples in the exhibit. Does anything stand out to you right away where you thought you stood in front of it and you went, huh, that was a good idea. Maybe we should try that. Anything stands out from the exhibit so far?
Well, it was more like the overall variety of everything. I mean, no story was alike. And I mean, there were just over 30 communities there. It's like, how do you choose? Yeah. But, you know, the feelings that I got from it actually is just hearing these stories. It's like they're not throwing money on a problem. And, you know, that's something a lot of communities don't have. Mm-hmm. It started with an idea. And then there was a leader or a group of people, and they collaborated to make this idea happen. And then they start building off each other's ideas, and they're having these hard conversations. And part of this is just taking risks, and they're learning from their failures, and they're also finding these resources to make their visions happen. And, you know, that's challenging for anyone, but they persevered and they were successful.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what you have coming up this week in the community room.
Yeah, so Empowering Futures, Friends of the Children, HESAPA, they are coming to talk about their long-term mentorship model, and what it does is it empowers children to overcome challenges and achieve their potential. We're really excited to have them.
Yeah, all right. So what do you see in the library this summer that also is encouraging you for community solutions and community conversations and reading programs? And let's expand our conversation a little bit beyond this exhibit and where it's set up now to talk about your mission in the library as a whole.
Yeah, so our mission is to provide a resource for our community, whether that is technology access or literacy, educational opportunities. We are there to provide that. We are a community gathering space. And, you know, we try to meet our community where they're at. We listen to what the community needs, and then we innovate. That's why we have the makerspace. We provide tools and technology that people wouldn't otherwise have access to, where they can bring their ideas and visions to life.
Tell me more about the makerspace.
Yeah, so we offer a laser engraver, and so we have small businesses that use these, and people make custom gifts. You know, it's pretty cool because you can, like, engrave on glass and acrylic, leather, wood. I know that some of the local taps around here are made on the laser engraver. They're wood, and so they're kind of cool to see. You can make your own stickers. You can customize a design and print your stickers. And, you know, all these things just cost the use of the consumable product. We're not making a profit off of it.
Yeah. How long do people see this exhibit, and what sorts of conversations do you hope, you know, when people walk through and they look at the traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian, how would you encourage them to engage with it in ways? Are there engagement opportunities built into the exhibit itself?
Yeah, so the exhibit goes till August 17th, and we just opened on Saturday, so there's still plenty of time to check it out. I think it's just really exciting for people to go in and just read these stories where these towns brought these educational opportunities. You know, that was technology access, sustainable jobs, improved infrastructure, and they bridged cultural divides. And so that is hopefully going to give us a chance to reflect and inspire ideas in us. Like, do we have this issue or a similar challenge? And what can we do to bring change and to innovate? How can we make an idea our own and apply it to our own unique needs and resources? What strengths can we harness? And, you know, considering the spirit of our community, I mean, those are the things that we want to see from this. And it's actually kind of cool. The Smithsonian provided these cards with asking various questions, and then there's like this drop box to put it in. So we're actually nice. Gathering these ideas.
Nice. All right. Are you reading anything great this summer?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the most popular things we do during the summer is our summer reading initiative.
Yeah.
It's we help children, teens, and adults just to prevent summer learning loss. And so we really challenge the kids to read, whether it's 15 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day. And we just have all these fun events to support them. There's tracking, there's prizes. And so it's just one of the ways that we can support literacy and education in our community.
Yeah. Well, when I'm in Rapid City, I always stop by the library. It's a beautiful space. So thank you so much for telling us about this exhibit and some of this programming. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Lorinda Tapper, Public Relations Coordinator at the Rapid City Public Library. Spark Places of Innovation is on display there now through August 17th, and there will be several events that tie into that programming. The exhibit then moves to Huron, Aberdeen, and Mission, and we'll put the links up to the dates for those on our website at sdpb.org/news. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow, we are going to bring you another teacher talk, and we will look at prayer in school and the famous landmark Supreme Court decision that addressed it with Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. We also have a new Fresh Tracks for you with some of the best songs that David Hirschroot says you should check out here in 2024. From all of us at SDPB, I am Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.